The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his six decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, this is Jeanette Garcia. We're hosting Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. And today we're going to be doing episode 18, round one. Louis, what are we going to be discussing today? What story are you telling us?
Round one. Well, round one is actually the start of one of my books, which is Strange Cases and Wild Tales, which has been getting 5-star reviews. And I'm very happy about that. Round one is a story about Angelo Dundee. When I first came to Miami, I had a neighbor. His real name was Jay Groff. I haven't disclosed him. He was an ear, nose, and throat doctor, an otolaryngologist. And he was a terrific guy. And he repaired the noses for a lot of the boxing fighters.
Oh, okay.
And boxers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure they had a lot of issues with that.
Yeah, well, they do. They have a lot of broken noses and septums that have
deviated
to be
septums.
Deviated mm-hmm. septums and fractures and all kinds of things. So he would be the one that they would come to. And he was friendly with the trainer of Muhammad Ali. Mm. Angelo Dundee was the trainer of Muhammad Ali. And he lived in Miami. And he owned the Fifth Street Gym, he and his brother. The Fifth Street Gym is on South Beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
South Miami Beach. And the famous boxers would train there.
Mm-hmm. Including, I think I've seen a photo of someone very special that you're going to mention.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali, uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Jimmy Ellis trained there. There's a lot of guys. And there was a cut doctor. A cut doctor is the doctor who repairs the cuts, you know, in the ring mm-hmm. when they get split, their skin open.
Right.
And his, he was a terrific guy. His name was Ferdy Pacheco. He's passed on. And so is Angelo. Oh. Angelo is married to Helen. They were clients of mine and good friends. I met them through Jay Groff. Oh. So Angelo, he was a very sweet, unassuming. You would never believe that he was a trainer of the world champ in a tough boxing profession. Mm-hmm. And he was just a very sweet, quiet, nice guy. And one day he said to me, Louis, I'm going to give you a boxing lesson. Would you like a boxing lesson? I said, sure, Angelo. He says, well, you put your dukes up, put your left and your right fists up. He says, then you punch with your left fist. And you say one to yourself. Then you punch with your right fist. And you say three to yourself. And he says, faster. One, three, one, three, one, three. I said, hey, Angelo, what happens with two? He says, that's when he hits you. It's a great story. And a true story. So did I really know Muhammad Ali's trainer? Yes, I did.
Did you ever have to use it, by the way? His boxing tip?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, I have a broken nose from a boxing. I was at Cornell, and my fraternity was very macho, mm-hmm. and they wanted everyone to make dean's list and on top of it earn their letter in a sport. Uh-huh. Well, I'm about 5'6", and I weighed about 147 pounds or something, 43 pounds at the time. And so I went out, I tried to play tennis, and these guys are 6'3" with big long reaches.
Oh, wow.
And Dick Savitt and Lenny Steiner, they turned pro. They were the first tennis pros back in the 40s, 48, 49, 50 in there. And I couldn't make the team. I was a good player, but not that mm-hmm. good. So I then went out for 150-pound football, and I couldn't make that.
Boy.
They had these kids from Pennsylvania, from
right.
Scranton,
you were almost there, just a
yeah,
little
they were,
bit.
They were coal miners. They were built like wires mm-hmm. and all strong. 150 pounds to them was like 200 pounds
right.
to me.
Yeah.
They knocked me over. So I couldn't play 150-pound football. I was desperate. And I went out for boxing.
Oh, okay.
And I went to the gym and I skipped rope and I put on the gloves and I thought I knew 1-3, 1-3. Well, there was a guy by the name of Jimmy Van Gilder. And he punched me in the face. I saw the glove coming at my face, and my nose split, splattered, and I had a broken nose, and that was the end of that. I finally got my letter in riflery. A nonviolent, no contact sport.
No contact.
I went down to the rifle range, and I had a shot in high school, and the Sergeant Latta, I'll never forget his name, took me under his wing, and I was shooting 300 to 500 shots a day after school.
Wow.
On the
you
range.
You found your calling.
And finally, I made the rifle squad and then the team, and then we went to the championships and came in second in the country. We
nice.
Beat West Point, and we beat Annapolis,
wow.
and
impressive.
We, you know, we the only team we lost to was Maryland. They were terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a very good shot. I could hit a bullet hole at 50 feet.
Wow.
With metal sights, and that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the first part of this really round one is the start of a trip,
mm-hmm.
and this trip starts like many. Trips, it winds up like many adventures on the shores of a remote barrier island. The remote barrier island was Miami Beach. And at that point, I was trying to find myself. I realized that my father wasn't a god, although his clients thought he was a god.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And remember, Mr. Ulitzi dropped to his knees in front of my father.
Great story.
And I realized I wasn't a super lawyer and was never going to be a super lawyer. Although my father said, well, if you're going to be a mediocrity, be the best mediocrity. So you remember that. Then I said, well, in some ways I did better than my father. And my sons, who both became super medical specialists, one a plastic surgery specialist and a hand surgeon too, on top of these triple boarded. Mm-hmm. And the other is a neuro-otologist. He restores hearing. To people with a cochlear implant.
Oh, wow.
A lot of children that never heard in their lives can hear because of him. So he's now retired, but they did better than I. However, my grandsons could wind up back in my parents' and grandparents' coffee and tea business, starting the cycle all over. What happens is, what's the cycle? The cycle is very interesting. It's the great-grandfather is a shoemaker,
mm-hmm.
and he's in Europe, and he's very poor, and he saves his money, and he gets out of Europe, and he immigrates to the United States,
mm-hmm.
and in the United States, his kids go into the coffee and tea business, and they have a little store with a wooden floor,
mm-hmm.
and they're selling coffee and tea and so on, and they struggle, and they send their first kid to college, the first to go to college,
mm-hmm.
and so my father became the first to go to college, and then on, he went to law school,
mm-hmm.
but he went at night, and then I'm the next generation, and I go to an Ivy League law school,
right,
top,
stepping it up,
you know, now with the rank, now my kids even outdo me, and then my grandchildren wind up hammering shoes. They want a simple life, and that's the cycle.
Yeah.
And I thought I was kidding around when I talked about the cycle, and I was in Israel, and in the museum they had the exact cycle on the wall, so it's not uncommon.
That's very interesting.
Anyhow, Arthur Godfrey, so he was a well-known promoter of Miami Beach, and it has been said that he was a very virulent anti-Semite.
Mm.
And there was a lot of anti-Semitism then, and I did and I'll talk to you more about that, the difference between anti-Semitism then and anti-Semitism now,
mm-hmm.
because then it was blatant, I mean, right out.
Right. Now it's like more subtle.
And now it's much more subtle. Yeah, that's the difference.
They
but
have to
there.
Be because they'll
it's
get in
there.
Trouble.
But he had a hotel, and I don't want to tell you the name. I'll call it the Blue Waters. And they allegedly had a sign right on the front desk when you came in, no dogs or Jews.
Huh.
And that's how it was. But Arthur Godfrey strummed a ukulele. You know, he was the old redhead. And he sang on the radio. And he publicized Miami Beach in the early days. And they really appreciated it because Miami Beach was relatively undeveloped. So they named a major crossroad for him at 41st Street on Miami Beach. It's called Arthur Godfrey Road.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try walking down that street today, you'll see groups of bearded men, all dressed in black, with wide-brimmed black hats. The women are walking behind them with long black dresses and long sleeves and scarves on their heads. And they're walking to the synagogue. The restaurants only serve kosher food, and it caters to Orthodox Jews, and they've taken over Arthur Godfrey Road, and mm-hmm. Arthur Godfrey must be rolling over in his grave.
Yeah.
And I'm
wonderful.
Sure when they wake up, they may consider because they're renaming everything, you know, with the South and the prejudice. And maybe they'll rename Arthur Godfrey Road. Anyhow, there's the bell, and it's the end of round one. So I know you want to know about the underlying message.
Yes.
All of my stories have an underlying message, mm-hmm. like Aesop, Aesop's fables, you know?
Right.
And he did a lot, you know, Aesop, of course, was a slave in Greece.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, in 500 BC around then.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I ever told you about Aesop, but I'm rambling. But he was famous for, you know, the fox and the grapes, mm-hmm, and the fox mm-hmm. jumps for the grapes and can't get them. And he gets frustrated and he walks away and he says, those grapes were probably sour. And you want them anyhow. So that's the story of when you're ticked off and you can't accomplish what you want to do.
You
say,
excuses,
it wasn't worthwhile anyhow. That's sour
right.
grapes. And then he had other sayings like birds of a feather flock together.
Oh, okay.
You know? And
I didn't know that came from him.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so he was so popular that they made him a citizen. Because in those days, voting only went to the rich mm-hmm. and the elite,
right.
The nobility, if you will. And no one else voted. So it was a great democracy, but the only people who voted were the very, very influential people. And they always voted. Yeah, and they had their own fights, you know. Mm-hmm. Within the Senate and so on, they were all rich people, mm-hmm. and they all had land. That was another qualification. And no women voted.
Yeah, no, of course not.
So
right?
that was some democracy that we aspire to. At any rate, some of the underlying messages. One of them is the 1-3 story with Angelo Dundee, is that life is a boxing match, and there's a lot of give and take, and you really have to survive by fighting mm-hmm. and scratching it out. It's not an easy ride, and you have to expect punches.
Yeah, you have to anticipate it.
Right, and we're all today, like with the virus, we're all fighting to exist, to pay the bills, to put food on the table. It's a never-ending fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing is society is very cyclical. So it's cyclical, and everything keeps moving. So when you think you're rich and you're well-educated, and everything's going well, from out of the blue,
something
lightning can
strike,
mm-hmm. and your whole life can change.
Yeah.
And you don't know
it's
when it's going to happen or if it's going to happen. But it happens a lot. If you ever notice, people who are very wealthy and powerful have a dynasty, and then suddenly it ends, and you don't hear anything about their children. What happens to the next in line? So if you look, for example, in the Bush family, mm-hmm. You had Barbara Bush, and Bush Sr., you know, and then the two brothers, mm-hmm. Who one was president, the other governor of Florida, and where are their kids? You don't hear about, Jimmy Carter's kids. They disappear. And if you look at some of the others, like the Kennedys' children, they have terrible tragic problems. They have emotional problems. They have psychiatric problems. There's a suicide.
There's
or
so
two
much
in the
tragedy
family.
In their life,
huh?
In their lives, like in their family history. There's just
plagued
with.
There's another message here mm-hmm. About Arthur Godfrey Road, and that is that hatred never goes away. It changes form, but it's there all the time. So, for example, slavery, and I'll tell you a lot about slavery. But slavery becomes economic exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
So black people no longer are possessions and slaves, but to a great extent, from the day they were freed from the Emancipation Proclamation.
The laws were written, and they were
in company towns. They had to work. They had the lousiest jobs. They were in the military. They dug ditches.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody appreciated them in combat. A black unit will do the same heroic feats as a white unit and get 1/10 of the medals.
Yeah, not get recognition.
They never got the Congressional Medal of Honor. So it was a very tilted, strongly mm-hmm. tilted playing field against them. And then against everybody else who wasn't a part of the elite. So the Jews had a tilted field, and their anti-Semitism exists and still exists in many industries and in many businesses, banking, in the State Department, which was anti-Semitic for a long time,
mm-hmm.
In manufacturing, large corporations, DuPont, things like that, big banks, at the top of the big banks. Now that's changed a lot, but it's still there. Insurance companies, you don't see the CEOs of insurance companies particularly being Jewish. And of course, in insurance companies, you don't see women. There's prejudice against women too, which we don't appreciate. Women are probably the most discriminated group of all, including the blacks. And that's why you hear angry women. They have a right to be angry.
Yeah, if a man gets angry, it's fine. But when a woman gets angry, despite having reasons, viable reasons, then we're being hysterical or emotional.
Well, there's a huge prejudice against women. Women were chattels, just like the slaves, just like the black people. They couldn't own anything. They had to obey the husband. Yeah. There were no divorces. They were raped a lot by their husbands a lot. It was terrible, and still is bad. So women have a, and they couldn't vote, and they couldn't own property, and they couldn't, they weren't free to move around, and there were no, the divorce was almost impossible to obtain for many, many centuries. So women have been treated terribly, and really slaves.
And that's here in the United States. Imagine in other countries.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
how much worse it is.
Yeah, it is slavery in many of those countries. And I hate to talk about religions, but I talk about people instead. Certain groups of people treat women very shabbily. They have to walk behind. They have to. They can't drive a car in some countries. And now the head of the country, the king, says, okay, you can drive a car. A woman goes out and drives a car. He arrests her. He says, you didn't get that for the women. I got that for the women. She was the spokesperson for the group. He threw her in jail. So you know where that was, don't you?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. That was Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So in the 1950s, you found that the racial hatred was out in the open. Hotels, residential communities. You couldn't buy a lot or a home in Bay Point, for example, in Miami, down downtown in a beautiful subdivision. You had to become a member of the club and in order to be qualified to buy the home or the lot. And, of course, club membership was restricted.
Right.
They had it in Naples until maybe 5 years ago where you couldn't buy in that subdivision unless you belonged to the club.
Wow.
And the club controlled who could buy there.
I didn't know things like that still existed.
Yeah. Then you had clubs, private clubs like the Riviera Country Club in Coral Gables, the Bass Club, the Surf Club over on the Miami Beach. They were restricted and there was no, and then you can fill in the blanks. The only thing they wanted were, you know, WASPs, Southern Protestant, Anglo-Saxon Protestants, white. The corporations were the same way. Fraternities at the colleges were the same way and still are.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned your time at Cornell.
Right, right. And sororities, too, and societies, professional societies. And I remember the Florida Bar didn't have any blacks in it. When I started practicing law, there weren't 20, 30 black people in the state that were practicing law. And then when they got into the bar, they put them in the back corner of the ballroom when we had a dance. One round table for the blacks in the back corner. Yeah, it was a separate society. And they lived together and they associated together. And the same, a lot of it was self-imposed. The Jewish people like to live in ghettos where they feel comfortable with one another. And they don't feel this anti-Semitism biting all the time.
Right.
And the black people have it. They can't drive.
That's all they had was their community.
I dealt with a black mortgage broker, very nice young guy, beautifully appointed, well-mannered, refined, and very elegant guy, and honest and competent. And he didn't show up on time for a couple of our meetings. And I said, where the dickens were you? It's not like you to be late. He said, oh, the cops stop me all the time. The police always stop me. I said, why?
Yes.
He said, they harass me. Why? Well, I've got a Mercedes-Benz new, and I'm driving, and I'm wearing suspenders and a custom-made shirt. And they look at me, and either A, they think I'm a thief, or B, they're jealous. And they put me against the car, over the hood of the car, and they frisk me. And he says, I'm used to it. He said, I just don't open my mouth. Just tell them, you can't talk back. You can't. If you open your mouth, they hit you. Then they say that you resisted arrest.
Terrible.
It's a very, very terrible thing.
And we've discussed this before, but what do you think has to happen in our country for this to resolve itself, to get better? What do you think has to happen between people? I feel like it's not an issue of policy. I feel like it's an issue of humanity. Like what do you think has to happen for
us? It's a gradual thing, and it's going to take a lot of education, and that's the key. But it's a very slow process, and it's a process of education and exchange of people working together. Look, there's a problem between the blacks and the Jews, and that shouldn't be. I mean, they're both being, downtrodden groups, and picked on. Mm-hmm. And so you get a guy like Louis Farrakhan. You know who he was?
No.
He's the Black Panthers, when he raises.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And a very militant guy. And he was very anti-Semitic. And even Al Sharpton, Reverend Al?
Yeah, yeah.
The Rev said some bad things, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and... Jesse Jackson, another minister, called the Jews Haimis and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 28% of black people have anti-Semitic views from my studies, my review. And 72, of course, do not. The Jews, 3% of the population, and about 50% of all of the hate crimes or more are directed against them. So you have a problem. 35% of American Jews say they experience hatred. One-third of all Jews conceal outward indications of their being Jewish. They conceal, they're afraid to say, so if you meet a guy and he said, my name is Lewis Martin instead of Lewis Riss, and he passed himself off as
There's a history of just
being non-Jewish.
Of being, hated.
Yeah, 19% of Americans believe that Jews control Wall Street, which is, totally untrue. So you have tremendous...
That's sort of like the mentality that Hitler tried to instill in the Germans, that the Jews were a threat, that they were controlling the country, that they were taking over.
That's
and all
America
they were doing was just hardworking citizens.
Well,
they weren't doing
anything.
Just
like anybody else.
Yeah, they weren't
some
doing anything
hard,
mischievous.
Some didn't work hard. Some were successful. A lot of Jews are poor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big Jewish charity effort to look after them, to feed them, and put them, especially Holocaust survivors that are poor, and as we, they have to be looked after.
They lost
then you
everything.
Get the Holocaust deniers.
Yeah.
You get all kinds of right-wing, angry, violence, terrorism. You get, look at the shootings in Pittsburgh and in Poway, California. They come into the shul with a gun, kill the poor Jews. Neo-Nazis do it.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the Holocaust deniers. So it's a, in fact, now even on college campuses, you have a lot of hatred. And the college campuses have trouble coping with it. They did for a while. Cornell had it, where these pro-Palestinian speakers got up on a platform and started shouting anti-Semitic diatribe, and the school didn't do anything about it. And they said, well, it's freedom of speech, but not freedom for hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools finally learned that you have to draw the line when somebody starts using hate speech.
Right.
And they've got to come in, just like you do on the internet, on Facebook
it can
and so
escalate.
On. You can't just let it go and say it's freedom of speech. And that now has come into focus. But 5 years ago, that was not in focus.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was okay because of freedom of speech.
Right.
And today we look at freedom of speech a little more skeptically. And we say, we don't want hatred.
Yeah.
And anyone that gets one of our scholarships that we give has to sign the REST pledge, which says, I have no hatred in my heart for anybody by virtue of race, religion, sex, national origin, whatever. And I had trouble getting the schools to comply with that.
Oh.
And they said, well, that's too restrictive. And I said, what are you talking about? You have scholarships for blue-eyed, blonde Christians, and you allow that to exist.
But you don't allow a pledge that
that's right.
Has tries to, be, to
has
eliminate
to be a,
hate.
A Methodist that has to be so, such colored hair. And so, I said, that's wrong.
That's nuts.
So
that is nuts.
That's existed. It goes on now. It goes on now. So I'll tell you an interesting story. My wife had a best friend, and she lost contact with her. And we came to Florida, and she saw her name. Her name was Astrid Pfeiffer. You can't have a name like that. That's unusual. Mm. She was the corporate secretary of Florida Power and Light. We saw it on one of the statements. So we looked her up, and she wanted to take us out to the bath club or the surf club or the Riviera Country Club because Florida Power and Light gave her memberships in all those clubs. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't go there, but we were paying Florida Power and Light every time for the use of the electricity.
Yeah, yeah.
All the people were paying, the black people were playing, and Florida Power and Light was giving memberships to its executives and these clubs that were restricted.
And, by the people paying them to run their company.
We finally stopped that kind of stuff. But that's what was going on. And it's been going on for a long, long time. So I think I talked to you about the rebirth of anti-Semitism in a different way, mm-hmm. And neo-Nazis, and the crazies that say the Jewish mafia killed John F. Kennedy, and the synagogue is the synagogue of Satan, pornography, Jews are pornographers, and is terrible stuff. Anti LGBTQ stuff.
LGBTQ.
You know? They hate gays. This is what we're living with, and I think it's going to take a lot of education and exchange information and an effort to work together. Which is happening, but slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay. Well, hopefully, it gets better. We keep talking to each other and learning from one another and hopefully, replace hate with understanding and compassion for others.
Right. I didn't even talk about the hatred for foreigners, including Hispanics.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone hates foreigners, but they forget that the DuPonts came over from France. Everybody's a foreigner.
Everyone, yeah.
In this country, yep. We're all foreigners.
We would all have to get out except the Native Americans.
You got it. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Louis. Until
thank
next
you.
Time.